On House Bill, or open up the House Committee on Business and Labor for whatever day this is today, the 20th, 21st of February. Okay, we're going to adjust the schedule a little bit. The first bill we're going to be hearing is Senate Bill 1558A. So I'd like to open up a public hearing on House Bill, or Senate Bill 1558A.
Madam Chair and committee members, this bill authorizes the director of DCBS to pay compensation due to workers of members of certain decertified self-insured employer groups and to set standards by rule for proof of financial viability of the self-insured employer and for insurance coverage retention and combined net worth of members of those groups. It prohibits certain group members and board members of groups from serving as the group administrator. It authorizes the DCBS director to revoke certification of self-insured employer in default and for violation of rules. Authorizes the director to take certain actions when a self-insured employer group is in default, is decertified, or cancels its certification. Modifies requirements for ending cash balance in the workers' benefit fund. Requires each group to conduct a vote on the continuation of the group and to report to DCBS by July 1st, 2014. Instructs the MLAC to conduct a study about the modification of the ending balance requirements and to report to the legislature. Designates an effective date of April 1st, 2014. There's no amendments. Came across the Senate on a vote of 30-0. MLAC supports the A engrossed version. There's no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement has been issued.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, we have two people signed up so far, Pat Allen and John Schultz. Let me come up.
Do you want me to go look in the hall?
We're going to have to get gavel this out and check. Yeah, he's doing a different bill, so.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, here to speak today briefly on House Bill 1558 in support of the bill. Jan did a great job, Ms. Nordland did a great job of outlining the what's in the bill. In brief summary, this is a problem that we became concerned about over the summer in terms of increasing instability in the small, in the group insurance market for self-insured workers' comp insurance. We've done a presentation to you before when you had a joint hearing with the Senate Business and Transportation Committee, and so I won't repeat what we talked about there. The bill really has three main features. It provides an orderly exit from this insurance product for groups that choose to go through that. There's a requirement that that the group members themselves vote on whether to continue in the group in a group or whether to take advantage of this opportunity. It uses the worker benefit fund to facilitate that orderly exit from the system. The worker benefit fund would, after liquidating deposits and other assets that the group has, the worker benefit fund would pay worker claims. The group members would continue to be responsible for their own group administrative costs, attorneys, accountants, administrators, those kinds of things. For those groups that elect to stay in the system and continue to operate as a group, it raises the standards so that the chances of this kind of an instability occurring in the future should be sharply reduced. And then it gives us a little bit of latitude with the worker benefit fund to take the balance of that fund to a level that's more consistent with the way we operate the other funds in the department for a period of time to facilitate this with the expectation that the fund will again rise to the 12-month current statutory balance. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have about the bill.
Okay. Would you like to go for – do you have something to say and then we can ask you
all questions? He's here in case I get stumped.
Oh, okay. Would you like to add anything? Or
just that I'm John Schultz, the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Yeah. Are there any questions for these gentlemen? Okay. No questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, is there anybody else that would like to speak on 1558A? Mr. Wilson?
Thank you, Chair Doherty, and members of the committee. For the record, J.L. Wilson representing Associated Oregon Industries. I just wanted to put on the record the department reached out to stakeholders when it became clear that this was going to be an issue several months ago. They consulted with a number of associations, AOI included. We came to the conclusion that this was making the best out of a bad situation. There's a range of tough options, and this was the best one that we saw to get out of this particular problem. And so we endorsed the measure. We think it needs to move. In the absence of this measure, the reality is there's going to be litigation as to who's responsible for claims costs, and the injured workers ultimately get left holding the bag with unpaid claims, and that is the worst possible outcome. So we feel this bill needs to move.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much for your input. Any questions for Mr. Wilson? Okay, thank you. Anyone else would like to speak on 1558? Okay. Seeing none, I close the public hearing on House Bill 1550, Senate Bill 1558A, and open up a public work session or work session on Senate Bill 1558A.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 1558. Maybe I had to get it right. 1558 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator, Representative.
Well, yeah, it is the first bill.
Bill promotion.
It's been a long week.
Senate bill, Representative Kenemer moves, Representative Commissioner Senator Kenemer moves Senate Bill 1558A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Thatcher.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I need to put on the record that I actually have an actual conflict of interest on this one because I am a majority owner of two businesses that were members of a self-insured group that is affected by this bill.
Thank you. And I do they have to?
Yeah, I think by the end of today, I have a written statement to the committee.
Yes.
Okay. I'll follow up with you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Any other questions? Any other discussion? Okay. Seeing none. Nick, could you call the roll, please?
Representative Pagan?
Yes.
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Is this a committee bill?
Representative Holby?
Nobody carried it.
Aye.
Representative Mackey?
Yes.
Yes.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
No.
Vice Chair Kenemer?
Aye.
Chair
Doherty? Aye. Okay, the motion passes. Would anyone like to carry this bill on the floor? Representative Witt would like to carry this bill.
I think Representative Barton should carry.
We should punish him for his vote.
Okay, with that, I close the work session on Senate Bill 1558A and open up a public hearing on which bill is, Senator?
1520. Senator started 1520.
On 1520. Okay. Thank you, Jan. If you could read the summary.
Madam Chair, committee members, this measure exempts from registration requirements those securities that are issued by a renewable energy cooperative corporation to the members of the corporation as evidence of membership or to show the members' respective interest in the assets, the reserves, or the patronage dividends. Becomes operative July 1st, 2014, declares an emergency. The Senate voted 29-0. There's no amendments before you. There's no revenue impact. There's a minimal fiscal impact with no statement issued.
Okay, thank you. Senator Starr.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Bruce Starr. I'm the senator that gets to represent Western Washington County. Appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning on Senate Bill 1520. This is really a simple bill that contemplates helping small-scale renewable energy projects go from ideas to actually getting built and installed. It's simple in that it just exempts these renewable energy co-ops from the securities registration that they otherwise would have to go through. It's a process by which we can encourage the funding of these small-scale renewable projects. If you look on OLIS and on your computer, you'll see that there's broad support from all over the state for this idea. I see it as a way to help to get these renewable energy projects installed, and I think it's an important bill. It's a simple bill. It's one that I think is good for all of us and good for Oregon. As you heard, the bill came out of the Business and Transportation in the Senate unanimously, and it came across the Senate floor unanimously. On the Senate floor, I talked about some of the testimony that we had in the Senate committee from the Department of Business and Consumer Department of Consumer and Business Services regarding their rulemaking process, ensuring that as they go through that process in these co-op situations, that they protect the public as it relates to basic information of the governance of the co-op, making sure that the co-op has some basic disclosure statements as it relates to the risks and benefits of membership, potentially limiting the number of investors or the amounts raised, and also the ideas of making sure that the public understands, whoever's going to buy into these co-op understand just the financial risks that are associated with that. With putting that on the record, we feel that it was appropriate to do that, and that DCBS is in a position to work with the stakeholders here as it relates to this bill, and you'll hear some more testimony in support of it behind me, that we, again, having the making sure that the public is protected. So that's the, in the nutshell, really what the bill does, and I would urge and ask for your support.
Okay. Do you have any questions of Senator Starr? Because actually, I did have a question about the protection, and you answered it. So
great. Thank you very much.
That was it. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Okay. Do you want these three together? Okay. We have Jamie Painter and Mark Pengilly, if I pronounce that correctly. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Doherty. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Pengilly, and I am here representing Oregonians for Renewable Energy Progress. We support the bill. As Senator Starr mentioned, it's a simple bill. It just does one thing. ORS Chapter 59 currently exempts from securities registration several kinds of cooperatives: fishing cooperatives, agricultural cooperatives, cooperative groceries. This bill would simply add community renewable energy cooperatives to the list of those cooperatives that are already exempted. It's an important bill because, as you've probably read from the letters that have been submitted all over the state, people have wanted to get together and form these small renewable energy projects, but they are stymied because of the upfront cost of doing so, and one of those significant costs is securities registration. Many people may not have a sunny roof, they may be residential tenants, they may be people of modest means, but they would still like to support and invest in local, clean, renewable energy projects. Now, I don't believe we have a single community renewable energy cooperative corporation in this state. So there are no examples in this state. They are being formed elsewhere in the country, in Maryland, in Massachusetts, and there are community projects going on in Colorado, excuse me, and in Washington State. Sometimes this may be just a group of half a dozen neighbors. They may lease a rooftop, or they may purchase or lease ground and put up a ground-mounted solar system. You could have a situation where several hundred people, a town, might put up a wind turbine. And many of the members of this cooperative are customers of the cooperative. They might receive a credit on their electrical bill for the power that's generated. In a larger situation, they might generate surplus power, and they might have a power purchase agreement with their local utility, and they would receive revenue for the electricity that they were feeding onto the grid, and the members of the cooperative would share in the benefits. This is important in the larger scheme because, as we all know, renewable energy is still expensive in this country. And you've read about the costs for Chinese-made solar panels dropping precipitously in the last few years. That drives down the hard costs for equipment. But in the United States, we're far behind Australia and Germany in our soft costs, which are permitting, financing, customer acquisition. One of those soft costs is the startup expense, in this case, of securities registration. So the more that we can reduce these upfront costs, the more we can drive down the price of renewable energy and allow it to scale all over the state in, with these small projects. Senator Starr mentioned the rulemaking. We had a good meeting with the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities on Tuesday of this week to begin discussing rules that, in lieu of securities registration, would be simple and would be inexpensive and would be available to a wide variety of consumer groups, yet would provide basic disclosures that would protect potential investors in these projects. So I think we're off to a good start on this, and I would ask your support for this bill. While it's a simple measure, it will provide benefits to people all over this state who want to do these sorts of projects but have had their eyes glaze over at the complexity and expense of securities registration. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Painter? Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jamie Painter, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Building and Constructions Trade Council and our 25,000 members across the state. We are here to testify in support of this bill. While the economy is coming back and we're seeing job growth, our rural areas are still working on building jobs. We think that this bill will create projects for our skilled labor and also produce clean, renewable energy and make it easier for us to meet the governor's 10-year energy plan. Thanks for your time.
Do you have any questions of the panel? You know, go ahead, Representative Holvey.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming forward. I think this is a worthy cause. I was curious, though, when you mentioned the expense of securities registration. Do you have a number of what that expense is?
Thank you, Chair Doherty. Representative Holvey, Representative Barton and I had a brief discussion about this the other day. I have been told that on a medium-scale project, these costs could range as high as $50,000, perhaps up to $100,000. That's probably high for a very small community project, it's very tough to get a lawyer to tell you in advance what something is going to cost. But I think it's fair to say this is tens of thousands of dollars for even a modest size project.
And then can you describe the discussion about the consumer protections that will be offered?
Yes, thank you, Chair Doherty, Representative Holvey. What we have begun to discuss with the Department of Consumer and Business Services is, first of all, we wondered, how is a community defined? How wide would that be? In most cooperatives, the customers are the owners, and there's a non-cash nexus between the members of the cooperative. So that was one issue we talked about. We talked about perhaps placing limits on the number of investors that would be in these projects or the size of their individual contributions, aggregate size of the project, things of that nature, and the disclosures as to governance risks to the investor.
Okay. Any other questions? I'm going to follow up a little bit with Representative Holvey, and so I know Representative Starr went through and talked about how DCBS would be going through and dealing with a lot of the regulations and so on. And so what specifically would DCBS go through and do? Because I think part of it is if it's not registered with somebody, who has the authority if we have a, you know, bad actor, sorry, Representative Gilliam, you know, in this?
Thank you, Chair Doherty. I believe the Department of Consumer and Business Services is here this morning.
Would they like to come up and answer this question? Because, Mr. Tapman, you are on the list also. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With your indulgence, I'd ask Rick Blackwell to join me. He's a policy analyst from the same agency.
Thank you.
For the record, I'm David Tapman, and I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. with an agency within DCBS, and we are charged with a number of regulatory responsibilities, including the oversight of the licensing of salespeople to sell securities and the registration of securities products, as well as enforcement of securities laws here in Oregon. So I'm happy to answer questions about this particular bill. I think at this late hour, you probably don't want a 101 overview of securities law, but I will tell you that...
Yes, we do.
Well,
no, we don't.
You're the chair, ma'am, and so we'll go ahead. The basic foundation is that securities are complex matters that involve people giving money to third parties and trusting that those third parties will carry out as they say they will do. Because of the number of securities frauds that we've seen over the last century and a half, there are a number of protective statutes both federally and in all 50 of our states. In Oregon, we do like most states, and we require registration of a product before it can be sold. Mm-hmm. Registration is designed to let an investor know how their money is going to be used, who it is that's going to use their money, what the end goals are for that money, what the risks of the operation are, how the officers of the company will receive compensation, how they can get in, how they can get out with their investment, things that are pretty basic and fundamental. Mr. Pangeli said that it can be expensive. It can be, but now we're talking about something that would be a national registration. This would be a local registration. I don't think it would be that expensive. Mm-hmm. Having said that, though, the bill addresses this as an exemption. An exemption would not require registration. In addition to registration, though, the agency is also charged to make sure that people are not defrauded, and that never goes away. This is a security. They cannot be sold by fraud. The challenge for us, of course, is if we see registration, we can prevent the fraud at the outset. If it isn't registered, then it comes to our attention after the sale, and all we can do is try and address the problem after the fact, which in essence means we're either pursuing somebody for a violation administratively, civilly, or criminally. To us, registration is a very important prophylactic for consumers or investors here in Oregon. With respect to the rulemaking process that we've described, we have, in fact, engaged in similar rulemaking in other areas. And so I call to your attention Oregon Administrative Rule 441-025-0060, in which we create what we call the sideboards for another cooperative type of enterprise, in which we have set forth boundaries by which these things can be sold. For instance, we limit the amount an investor can put into that. We limit the number of shares that can be sold, things like that. And so we believe we have that general authority to do just that, and it would be our intention to take charge from this body, the legislature, and make sure that consumers are protected should they invest in that. Our concern, of course, is not what Mr. Pangeli is talking about. Our concern is that any time you put a new exemption in securities law, you have put up a red flag for con men all over the state, mm-hmm. and con men mm-hmm. will take full advantage of that. And the broader it's written, the more the opportunity for fraud. So what our goal is, this is a very broad exemption. It just says if you're a renewable energy cooperative corporation, mm-hmm. well, who's to say who is and who isn't? So we want to make sure that we define what that is, how membership is indicated, that there's a certificate of authority to do just that from Secretary of State, and then we'd go into the size, the amount of money that could be invested, the nature of where the money would be held. Most likely would require some form of escrow, meaning that the money would have to be held until a certain dollar amount is raised. So if the project would cost $300,000, which in our conversation this week sounded like it was somewhat of a midpoint for many of these projects, and they only raised $100,000, we would prevent that from going out and being spent on salaries and office furnishings and things like that. So there are a lot of protections we can use.
Be into the rulemaking process.
This would have to be in the rulemaking process, okay. Because as I understand, looking at the bill, as it says right now, it doesn't lay that out.
Okay.
So we think we can do that. I will say on the record that if we're proven wrong by someone taking us to court and challenging that and successfully having a court overturn our rules, that we will be back to address this.
Okay. Other questions? And Representative Barton?
I didn't mean to interrupt, please.
No.
Oh, question, please. Mr. Tapman, thank you. So I gather from that, it's very
you believe, but you're not absolutely certain that you have authority to put the sideboards on place. Is that correct?
Representative Doherty and Representative Barton, yes. Our enabling statute for rulemaking is pretty broad. It allows us to establish classifications in other aspects of securities law. In addition, and I'll just put this on the record right now, we have a blanket authority to create brand new exemptions.
But what was my next question?
If the legislature gets ahead of us, then we have to operate within that exemption as opposed to us going forward with our own exemption. Okay. Honestly, we're going to look at that, but it's possible we'll have parallel exemptions, and we may do something parallel to what's going on here under our own authority.
So my next question then. So I get it. Let's pretend this bill did not pass. You could right now create a limited exemption for this type of renewable energy cooperative, could you not?
Madam Chair and Representative Barton, in fact, that rule I just cited you to was exactly that. We used our authority to create a new exemption, and this is a cooperative for manufactured housing parks.
Okay. Mr. It's Pengelly, right? Sorry. Why is this bill necessary?
This bill, thank you, Chair Doherty and Representative Barton. This bill is necessary because there has not been movement in this direction before. And if you've looked at some of the records coming, the letters coming in, there are people all over this state who have run up against this barrier and have been stopped. And so they have contacted their legislators, and the legislators are trying to help them move forward to provide the impetus for reducing these upfront expenses through an exemption.
Follow up?
Okay,
Mr. Tatman? Is the department prepared to move in this direction if the legislature doesn't act today?
Madam Chair and Representative Barton, yes. In fact, as I indicated to Mr. Pengelly and his group the other day, we probably would be able to get something underway. Realistically, it'll take us at least 6 months. But whether you pass the law and we do it under the law, or whether we did it ourselves, we're talking about fall, the beginning of fall to the end of fall of this year.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Representative Witt.
thank you very much, Madam Chair. Mr. Tatman, when Mr. Pengelly came into my office and explained this concept to me, I jumped at this. I think this is an effort that's intended to enable us as a state to move forward with neighborhood solar energy projects that will help so many people have cost-effective energy in their homes. And many people, even in rural parts of the state where energy is so expensive, to be able to make that affordable. With that said, I am very concerned about your earlier statement that people are inclined to do no good, end up doing no good. Let's suppose that there was hypothetically an effort, a neighborhood attempting to install a solar energy project so that they could all enjoy the benefits of net metering. And let's suppose we had a very large electric co-op. And in fact, in this state, we do co-ops that not only cover neighborhoods, but cover multiple communities. So let's suppose we had a rogue management who decided that there were significant investments in the delivery system, the cables that deliver energy in those communities, and that it was unaffordable for them to net meter because the cost of those cables was so expensive. And let's say that as a solution to their dilemma, they decided that anytime anyone attempted net metering, that they were going to start charging the individual customers for the cost of those lines, making net metering actually impossible for anyone to achieve. Would you be able to step in and control some kind of rogue management for a cooperative that perhaps got out of control and was running things contrary to the interests, the broader interests, I think, of what any one of us would consider to be the principles of a cooperative?
Madam Chair, Representative Witt, let me kind of absorb that, process it, but my reaction is multiple. One, just put another layer on this. There are exemptions already exist for anything that's under the auspices of the PUC. So if a product is sold that's a PUC-regulated source of energy, they are already exempt. And so the PUC essentially steps in and says, we're going to regulate this and make sure rogue operations like that are stopped. When you're talking about something that covers multiple communities, not to put the initials or a label on any particular company, but something of the magnitude that you're describing, I believe PUC is already involved there, and that probably is more appropriate. Our expertise is around the securities law, not necessarily around public utilities, transmissions of energy, and so forth. But to get to your specific question, our goal would be to probably put sideboards on to drop it down to just a certain number of investors and a certain amount of dollars raised. My feeling is if you get up above a certain dollar amount, you should probably be going through registration anyway. And the registration would have to disclose how they intend to use that money, including that they would be transmitting over these captured lines of transmission, and that they would be available for net metering or it wouldn't be available. That would be one of the many risks that we would expect to be disclosed in a registration statement. So without being able to say yes or no to you, I think a matter of that complexity probably shouldn't be in this type of exemption. A matter of that complexity should be subject to the full-blown registration that is envisioned in Chapter 59 already.
Madam Chair.
Please.
And I appreciate that very much, and thank you for your answer. I want to see this go forward, but I am there's a part of me that says caution. You know, those caution flags are up, that the competing interests, as bad as I want Mr. Pengilly's project to go forward, and by the way, he happens to be a constituent, so it's even more important. But as important as it is to me for this to go forward and for us to be able to incentivize the development of renewable energy in this state, I'm worried about potential unintended consequences for consumers. And so anyone who can give us that kind of assurance, it would be helpful for me at this time.
Madam Chair, Representative Witt, you just encapsulated why we came forward. We have the same concerns, and I think that's why we would like to put sideboards on this. Ideally, what we would do is take this into a process, and we would have the Department of Energy, we would have PUC, we would have other people, including Mr. Pengilly, come together, and we would put together a concept and a process. We will do that through our rulemaking, but our ability to be maybe as broad and inclusive as you're describing, Representative Witt, may not exist.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Thatcher?
Well, I guess I'm wondering, we're not inventing the wheel here. We're kind of looking at other states, I would think. What has been the experience in other states? I think Washington does something similar to this. Do they not?
Thank you, Chair Doherty, Representative Thatcher. We have relatively little experience so far in Washington State. They do exempt cooperatives from registration, and there are some community projects that are going forward in Washington. I can't say with certainty today that those community projects are cooperative corporations in Washington. I just don't know the answer to that. One thing we do have here in Oregon is the Energy Trust of Oregon, which on many renewable energy projects provides a degree of oversight before they will give tax credits and incentives, and they have a list of trade allies who are reputable installers of renewable projects that go forward. I think that in any of these projects, what they have to disclose is what the stream of revenue is going to be and what the cost of this installed project is going to be. So Representatives Witt's question might be addressed by the existence of net metering rates or the existence of a power purchase agreement that would have been negotiated before this project would have been constructed.
Thank you. Mr. Tatman, I noticed this bill has an emergency clause. Let's assume that it passes the legislature. That means this exemption will be in law about a week from now. Presumably, it will take you and your agency some time to put the sideboards that we're all counting on So that there's going to be, how long will it take you? It seems like at best case scenario, say 4 months, there will be a 4 month window there where there is this securities exemption that has absolutely no sideboards in place. Am I right?
Madam Chair, Representative Barton, that would be correct. My understanding is the bill's emergency clause takes effect at the start of the new fiscal year, July 1.
2014, Section 2. Thank you.
Well, but nonetheless, your question's a valid one. Mm-hmm. It will be a minimum of 4 months. I'm predicting 6 months because mm-hmm. we will pull together this very type of group I've described. Then we will go through proposed rulemaking, and then we'll go through and have a public hearing. So we'll do the process just as we normally would do.
Okay, Representative Hovey.
Mr. Tatman, you know, it sounds like you're putting together sideboards that are probably similar to what securities registration requires up front. And you're going through this process, and I'm just wondering, how is this paid for by your agency? There is a minimal fiscal expenditure impact, and I'm just kind of curious. It sounds like this is going to be a bit of work for your agency, and I know you don't really get a lot of general fund dollars, if any. And so I'm curious how the department will manage the cost.
Madam Chair and Representative Holdy, this would be a one-time event if we did it right, and so we'd go through the rulemaking process, and yes, we would absorb that cost. We do have fees built in, or we do have funding built into that, so we have a balance that will allow us to do this. If we had to treat this as a registration every time, then we would be charging a fee for that for our persons, whoever's looking at it, for their the use of their time. It's possible we could even put a fee into this for filing a notice, which is certainly something we could consider doing. There's a lot of options we would look at. In talking with Mr. Pengelly and others, the indication we got was that, at least in solar energy, they're anticipating the next 5 years, maybe 24 projects coming forward of a relatively small size, under $500,000 each. And so we don't expect to be bombarded with a number of these. Now, I could be wrong, and we could be pleasantly surprised that a lot of these come in. I just don't think that's the case based on what I've heard about energy costs and the ability to compete with the cost of hydropower right now.
Okay, thank you. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Pengelly, I want this to go through very badly, but I am scared about what I don't know, and I am not a securities expert, and I am just concerned that our intervention as a legislature may create more problems than it helps, and I'm wondering if there is an opportunity for you to work with Mr. Tatman and request the kind of exemption that you need that would enable you to move your project forward. Is that a workable solution in this instance?
Chair Doherty, Representative Witt, do you mean in lieu of
this piece of legislation?
I think without this bill, there would have been no impetus to initiate this process.
I understand.
And I think that it's the expression of people across the state to start this process. I think now that this process has started, we have, in a sense, already begun the segue into rulemaking with a conversation that we had on Tuesday of this week. So I think it is important to all those people who have wanted to see these projects move forward that the legislature show a response and initiate the process, and now we have the experts in the division to work with and shape rulemaking, and we anticipate working with them. So I think I would prefer to continue on this course. Rulemaking would achieve the same end regardless of how it was initiated, but I think it's important now that we've initiated it to have the legislative intent there to guide the rulemaking.
Well, and I also appreciate the need sometimes to get the attention of state agencies, but I think you've got their attention at this point.
Well said.
Representative Holby.
And thank you. I apologize for another question, but Mr. Tapman, you had mentioned that this bill provides a very broad exemption, whereas if you were to do this internally through your authority for exemptions, you could make this a much narrower exemption and therefore perhaps alleviate some of the fears that I think I'm hearing from this committee about making this narrower so that we wouldn't be as exposed to potential fraud in the future.
Madam Chair and Representative Holby, that's exactly correct. That's what we are saying. If I could just maybe pose a suggestion, there's an emergency clause that makes this effective July 14th. I don't see an emergency. I don't know that we couldn't put another date in there. I know amendments at this late hour are not well received, but if there's a concern that things aren't going to get done because you're just taking the pressure and focus off of us and we may just dilly-dally around for the next year, if you put in an effective date subject to some provision that we get this done first, possibly that would allow for it. Because then you've got the assurance that we're moving forward, and then we've got the concern the legislature's established that they want us moving forward. Mm-hmm. But it's our intention, I'm putting it on the record now, our intention is to go forward with rulemaking. I've already engaged my registration staff, and Mr. Blackwell here is our administrative hearings specialist, so we'll be doing that.
Because I have confidence that you guys will do that. And this is not new. I mean, there are other co-ops that are exempted that the renewable energy co-op is asking for the same thing as agriculture, fisheries, a couple of other
grocery stores
and that kind of thing. So this is not like new ground for you when it comes to rules.
Madam Chair, if I could just make a point, those three types that you've identified are either producing co-ops, people that are engaged in the production, whether it's sugar beets or salmon fisheries or oysters, or they're in consumer co-ops such as groceries or REI. Contrary to what you've heard in discussions this week, it's our understanding that most of the people are really just going to be investing because they believe in this and they want to see it go forward. There may never be this net metering. There may never be people actually receiving renewable energy electricity directly to them. To me, there's a difference. To me, this is more of an investment in the community with people with good hearts wanting to do the right thing. But it doesn't necessarily fall within that same category where you have people that are experts in their area. People that are salmon fishermen, the fisher people, know what's going on to some degree. People who are just in the community and believe solar energy is the way to go may have no understanding of how these various electrical transmission services work. And so that's where the disclosure part is so important.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other questions?
Chair Doherty, may I make a comment? I think, in a way, these renewable energy cooperatives are very analogous to agricultural cooperatives. They are producing something. They are harvesting the sun. Mm-hmm. They are generating electricity. In some of the states, notably Colorado, there is a solar garden statute where the community members would each own a certain identified solar module within a larger mm-hmm. installation. And so very much like the agricultural situation there. And I believe when we were talking with Mr. Tapman earlier in the week, I asked him about the history of with fraud of other cooperatives in this state, and I will run the risk of putting words in his mouth since he's right here, but I think he said in 20 years he had one experience where there was a difficulty with one of these cooperatives, and I'm here to stand corrected. So I think we have to keep in perspective the size of these things, the connection between the people in the community, and the relatively small amounts of money that they will be risking with one another in their community endeavor.
Yeah. Right, thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Blackwell, do you want to add anything? Or?
No, for the record, Rick Blackwell, Senior Policy Analyst, the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. I think my boss has said it well enough.
Oh, it's hard to get that one right.
It's a skill known
yes.
when not.
Mr. Tapman would agree.
Yes. Madam Chair?
Yes.
I kind of discerned a little doubt in that statement.
If I can amend my statement, I have total confidence.
Thank you very much. Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Well done.
Okay. Yeah. I think what we'll do is we'll carry this over till Monday. We're going to be carrying over the hearing and the work session until Monday, because there's still some questions. And I think one of the suggestions about possibly a different date for implementation might be a good idea. Okay. With that, anybody else signed up? We've got, or anyone else would like to speak on this issue? Okay, seeing none, I close the public hearing on House Bill, Senate Bill 1520A. And I open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1549. Could be this open?
Madam Chair and committee members, this measure clarifies that the statutory provisions regulating investigators do not apply to persons authorized to engage in public accountancy in Oregon. Declares an emergency effective on passage. No amendments before you. No revenue impact. No fiscal impact. Came from the Senate on a vote of 30-0.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we've got Eric Godlix, Rob Moody, and Martin Pidononi. Yeah, butchered two out of the three, I'm sure. So. Okay, welcome, gentlemen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Rob Moody. I'm a CPA licensed in the state of Oregon. And I believe you have my testimony in front of you, so I'd like to summarize what it is we're seeking here today, which is an exemption from ORS 703.411 for CPAs and their employees. The work of a public accounting firm has long since and traditionally included the analysis and evaluation of financial data in a number of realms, if you will. And CPAs are currently licensed under the State Board of Accountancy. We believe that it was never intended under 703.411 to require dual licensure of CPAs in the state. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Representative Doherty, members of the committee. My name is Martin Pitioni. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Accountancy. You have my written testimony before you. I'm not going to read it to you. I just want to very briefly summarize for you why the Board is involved in this bill and is asking you with support of the Governor's Office to support this bill. This issue is one that, quite frankly, if with your support, would also help solve an operational problem for the board. And the reason for that is that, you know, one of the key pieces that we have in our toolbox to protect the public is not just the two investigators we currently have on staff, but because of the, quite frankly, the scope of the profession, the types and the complexity of our cases, we have to have this tool of being able to contract out investigations to private, to CPAs that basically do investigations for the board. And quite frankly, those are not easy to find. And having them undergo a potential dual licensure requirement is a problem for us, and we quite frankly would like to preserve, to not necessarily have that, to have that dual layer. Quite frankly, from a public policy perspective, all this bill really does is take the existing public policy that's already there in the DPSST statute, and that basically says, hey, if you are a member of a licensed profession, such as an attorney or an engineer, you shouldn't have a dual licensure requirement. All this bill really says is that should apply similarly to CPAs as well, and that is also, quite frankly, really consistent with what you see around the country in those states that have private investigator licensure requirements, that you have basically carve-out exemptions of this type. And that's why, you know, the board is in support of the board is in support of this, and we respectfully ask for support of the committee.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Skablix. I'm the Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, also known as DPSST. Our agency licenses or certifies more than 35,000 public safety professionals in the state through legislative authority. Less than 1,000 of those are private investigators. You might wonder why we regulate private investigators. Years ago, there was a state group called the Oregon Board of Investigators, which was a standalone state agency that quite honestly couldn't financially stand on its own. The legislature asked if we would take that on as a mission, and we have, and we've been regulating that industry for a number of years. The proponents of this bill met with us. This clarifies what we already do. We do not go after people in this profession who are involved in financial investigations, although when we met with the proponents, they talked about issues in other states that we're aware of where they haven't looked at it this way. We have no issues with this bill. It codifies what we're doing already.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? Okay, so in other words, a CPA with a camera outside of a bank on somebody, that's not the kind of investigation that you want to do, I guess. Okay, thank you very much for the clarification. Okay, anyone else want to speak on Senate Bill 1549? Okay, seeing none, it closed the public hearing on Senate Bill 1549 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 1549.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1549 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Kenner moves Senate Bill 1549 to the House with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Nick, will you take the roll, please?
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Freeman?
Excused.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenner?
Aye.
Chair Doherty?
Aye. Okay, motion passes. Okay, do we have a carrier on this one? Anyone like to carry this one?
Thatcher's.
Okay, Representative Thatcher. Carry the bill to the floor.
Okay.
Okay, last bill for today. We've got Senate Bill, I open a work session, public hearing on Senate Bill 1537A.
Madam Chair and committee members, this measure specifies that a mutual pool for live or previously held horse races may include amounts carried forward from the mutual pool of previous races, authorizes the Racing Commission to adopt rules to identify forms of mutual wagering that race meet licensees may offer, provides the devices used by race meet licensees to offer mutual wagering in accordance with the Commission rules are not considered slot machines or gray machines. No amendment before you. Minimal revenue impact with no statement issued. There's no fiscal impact. The Senate voted on this 29-0.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I'd like to call up Mike Dewey, Ron Sutton, and Linnell Smith. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey, representing Portland Meadows. And thank you for hearing this bill. Dave Nelson, a longtime standing lobbyist, represents the Quarter Horse Association, and he's testified on this measure and other measures like this previously. He had an accident yesterday, and he could not be here. And
hope he's okay.
We just wanted it was not a good situation, but he's in the hospital. Hopefully, he'll be fine. But
okay.
I just wanted to point that out, that he's always here and could not be here today. So thank you again for hearing this bill. You may recall the discussion about historic racing and the legislation that passed in the last session. House Bill 2613 came through this body, passed the Senate, signed by the governor. And this is the bill that, and I'm kidding, you know the winners before the race is held. That was what people thought until we had a good discussion about what it does. And we also talked about the economic impact of racing in Oregon, which is very significant to the racetrack, the owners, the breeders, and others in this business. So what happened, unfortunately, is as we were implementing rules, we missed a portion of the statute. And the Department of Justice had essentially told the Racing Commission, and there is a representative from the Racing Commission here, that we were not able to implement the rules because of the definition of mutual and the definition of wagering pools. And in essence, in this bill is needed notwithstanding what we do with historical racing and whether or not we even adopt rules, and hopefully we will, but this will take some time to do with the Racing Commission, the Governor's Office, and the Department of Justice. And we had talked about that previously before this committee in 2013. Basically, the premise for historical racing is that there may not be a winner for that particular pool, for that particular race. And as such, the statute implies that the pool will pay out for all winners.
Live in the world.
He can tell the difference.
Thank you.
The chief hasn't changed him, huh?
Getting back to that. So with some wagers that we have at the track today and tracks across the world, and for the way that historical racing is set up, there may not be a winner. And if there's not a winner, then the pool carries over. Similar to the Powerball, for example. If there's not a winner on the Wednesday or Sunday, whenever that is announced, the pool, the amount of money in the pot carries over. Well, the Oregon statute, both for the definition of mutual and the wagering pool, implies that you cannot do that. You have to pay out after that race. So this is what this bill does. And again, the Attorney General brought this to our attention. We also put in the bill, somewhat at the recommendation at the DOJ, that we wanted to make sure that these types of races, which are pari-mutuel races, in the sense that these are, in this case, horse races, and these are wagers amongst the individuals in that particular pool, as opposed to wagers against the house. And we wanted to make it very clear that these are not slot machines or gray machines in case there was, quite frankly, any litigation. Because there may someone may argue that these are not rate pari-mutuel machines. In essence, these are, we'll say, slot machines. So if I may, Madam Chair, I'll just go a little bit further. There have been, throughout the discussion on this bill, and there was no opposition in the Senate, but I see that there's somebody who is opposed to the bill today. There's been some hallway discussions about a couple of parts of this bill or procedure. And part of that is, might this, by virtue of passing this bill, might a racetrack like Portland Meadows morph into a casino? Private facilities in the state of Oregon cannot have casinos. That's in the Oregon Constitution. In 2012, there was Measure 82 that was defeated by the voters that would have allowed for private casinos. Clearly, we cannot have a private casino. We cannot have slot machines. We can have pari-mutuel wagering. So there's longstanding court decisions there. The other discussion was, well, this might proliferate into additional racetracks in Oregon because they could now take advantage of the legislation allowing for historical racing. I just don't think that's going to happen. We have one racetrack. This is limited to commercial racetracks. I talked to the general manager of Portland Meadows about what would be the cost of building a racetrack. And he had mentioned, he had heard, this is the Meadowlands in New Jersey. They redid their grandstand in the backside where the barns are and the like, and that was about a $90 million project. So I don't think anybody's going to build a racetrack to take advantage of this particular piece of legislation. Lastly, I want to say that as we move forward, this will be a discussion of rules. You've heard a previous discussion about rulemaking here, and it will not necessarily be easy to get there. In the sense, we'll be talking about hours of operation. Somebody had suggested you're going to be doing criminal background checks. The employees already are licensed by the Racing Commission. There are background checks, as I understand. So that discussion will occur between the track, the Racing Commission, and the Department of Justice. I've been through these rulemakings before, and they are very intense, and they take a while to do. So notwithstanding historical racing, we need this legislation to keep doing what we do today at the track. But at the same time, we need to amend the mutual pool to do that. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to stop at this point if you want me to ask answer any questions, however you want to have the panel go forward.
That's a different take. Any questions of Mr. Dewey?
Madam Chair, just a comment. So in your mind, the concerns that have been raised are addressed in that the Constitution prohibits the creation of new casinos, and the cost of trying to ever create another horse track are just phenomenally high. And then the final safeguard is this very extensive process that you may not even be able to get through. That would pretty well clarify that you're not going to be putting these casinos around all over.
Madam Chair, Representative Kennedy, so I had previously represented the Greyhound track. As you know, the mm-hmm. Greyhound track is now closed. We are not building any racetracks in the United States. Hollywood Park is closed. So this is another tool that we think we need to continue the business plan. Because of the summer racing, that has helped. It's not the panacea by any means. And then it's very, very clear that we cannot operate a casino. We had passed a bill on behalf of Portland Meadows and the Greyhound track a number of years ago, and the governor vetoed that bill, and it dealt with video lottery machines and a number of machines. And the governor vetoed it on the advice of the attorney general that would create a casino. So we can't do that. We can operate pari-mutuel games, and that's what we do.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, representatives. I'm Linnell Smith. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Thoroughbred Owners and Breeders Association. It's a pleasure to see you all again. On behalf of our board of directors and our members, I wish to state our complete support for Senate Bill 1537. We sincerely appreciate this committee's commitment to saving horse racing in Oregon. Thank you.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, my name is Ron Sutton. I'm the president of the Oregon Horsemen's Benevolence and Protection Association, which is, we refer to it as OHBPA because the rest is a mouthful. I represent 800 owners and trainers of horses in the state of Oregon. Well, horse racing is a $200 million a year industry in the state. And we've been struggling to survive for many years. As many people well know, the horse track in Salem is gone. We talk about building new tracks. We're losing tracks. This bill helps provide a revenue source for the horsemen and women in the state, and we strongly support it, Bill 1537. If you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to try to answer them.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of this? Mr. Dewey, I do have one question, because there's been some questions as to whether the pari-mutuel machines and the historical racing, whether it could constitute, and it's in the statute, but it's a little vague to me, whether it also could be interpreted as a gray machine or slot machines.
Well,
so what is the intent of
so
that?
So, Madam Chair, we had trying to go back to the discussion we had with the a meeting with the Racing Commission, the Department of Justice representatives, and the governor's office, and trying to figure out exactly how we were going to solve the issues that were brought up as we started rulemaking, you know, initially after the first bill passed, 2613. And so the discussions were around, which I probably should have mentioned, were around is the pari-mutuel historical racing program, is it? They wanted to know exactly how it worked. And casino games, by and large, are random. If you do a slot machine, you are, you know, pulling something, however it works. I haven't done that for a while. That's all random. Pari-mutuel is not, because you have information about the horses, the jockey, and as such. So as we had that discussion, they wanted to be sure that, and this is more than you may want here, but the Department of Justice wanted to make it very clear that historical racing was not going to be random, that there was enough information for the wagerer to make an informed decision if they chose to wager. And part of that discussion was very interesting in the sense that the Department of Justice thought that it was random if you did not allow the person who was going to wager on a race to pass on that particular race, which is the race that's already been run, that's presented to you. And they thought that was random in the sense that the person may not feel they have enough information. Now, in a casino game, a slot machine, for example, you have no information. You're just hoping that the algorithm hits at the appropriate time. So in our discussions, and we haven't had any further discussions because of the issue with the wagering pool, Portland Meadows said, what we're going to do is we will make sure that if somebody wants to move on to the next presented race, they can, or the race after that. So by virtue of getting into these kind of discussions, it makes it very clear that we are not operating gray machines, which is in the, there's a provision in the statute for that, which are illegal machines, and we're not operating slot machines. And in part, we did that because there may be litigation. Somebody may argue that we are constituting, by virtue of what we're doing, a casino. And we think that protects us in that legal discussion.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, Lee Shin. Well, Mr. Shannon.
Hello, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. My name is Lee Shannon. I'm an attorney here representing the Klamath tribes in the area, in Chiloquin, and in the area of Klamath Falls, Oregon. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in opposition to 1537. I'm here to provide some of Klamath's concerns with the bill, Senate Bill 1537. Senate Bill 1537, which we understand is presenting, making technical changes to the prior bill, House Bill 2613. The interaction of the two is what's causing concern for the Klamath tribes, and sort of the discussion of what they are concerned about is the possibility of widespread private casinos or racinos, combined racetracks and casinos in Oregon. These gaming devices that are being authorized by Senate Bill 1537 look and feel, walk and talk like a slot machine. These types of displays that they have, these devices have traditional slot machine displays where cherries line up, or sevens line up, or jackpots line up. In the right-hand corner, there'll be a little window, 2 to 3 inches, which shows the ending of a race. Our understanding is they can run a race or show the final part of the race every 1.6 seconds to let the machine choose for you. They do draw upon an outcome of races, of thousands of races, and they use a random number generator to, you can choose a race, or you can use the random number generator to draw from those old outcomes and draw from the horse winner. So that combined with the speed at which they can be played, the way the display presents itself to this consumer causes concern for the Klamath tribes. The player's experience is the experience of a slot machine, and it's not the experience of a horse race. Our concern is when you combine the two bills, House Bill 2613 and Senate Bill 1537, you end up with something that provides no geographical limits on the license holders. Anyone who can apply for a license and get through the process can get a license. And there was some talk about $1 million. I've worked on financing scores of casinos. $1 million is nothing. I've worked on financing for casinos at $500 million. So when you do a business plan, a feasibility study, that amount of money is really small. There's no limits on the number or types of machines. A venue could have hundreds or perhaps even thousands of machines. If it was limited, If the legislation said 10 or 20 or 30 or 50 machines, then there'd be a finite limit. But as it is now, you can run your business plan, you know, on the number of machines that would be profitable based upon the population size. There's no limits on the hours of operation. Then you can operate here, unless there's rules promulgated elsewhere later, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. There's no strict regulatory regime in place. Venues can be vulnerable to organized crime. It authorizes private gaming in Oregon. We're now starting down that slippery slope where you're legitimizing the private casino concepts. Historically, it's been the Oregon Lottery and tribes and their governments, and they use the revenues for governmental services. And right now, you're creating the exemption of the machines, as was noted, would be exempt from the criminal laws related to slot machines or gray machines. Klamath tribes are concerned about the creation of private gaming in Oregon. Our written testimony, we provide greater details to bring the legislation into line with what we've been informed has been the intent of the legislation, such as specifically limiting it to the application of the Portland area, whether you do that by population size or some other means, implementing a strict regulatory regime, and providing for an explicit number of machines. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify here today. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Are there any questions? Mr. Shannon. The only question I had, because and I've not gone out to the track, so I don't know what these machines do, but did you say that on the historical racing machines that there was a little picture or something and you could pick the winner?
Correct. And I've sent to some of you, and I can send to the rest of you later, a link that displays some of these on YouTube. Other states have dealt with these same historical racing machines. They look like a slot machine.
Well no. But the reason is that if you can pick the winner, that's not random, is it?
Well, what it's doing is it's giving you choices. One, you can pick or opt in or opt out of specific races, or you can just hit the button and let it pick for you. But it's going to pick from a finite pool of races, finite pool of winners.
No, but it's still not
a random number generator.
But if I pick it, then it's not random.
Correct.
And that was
what
my question was.
But if you let the machine do it, it's going to use a random number generator. It's still not purely random like a Class 3 slot machine, which is purely random. It's more like a Class 2 slot machine, which is drawing from, you know, a certain set number of outcomes. So this is...
But I can still pick the winner.
Correct.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Shannon.
Thank you.
Okay, those were the only three that we had signed up. Is there anyone else that would like to speak on Senate Bill 1537A? Okay, seeing none, I close the public hearing on Senate Bills 1537A and open up a work session.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1537A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Kennemer moves Senate Bill 1537A to the floor, the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Nick, could you call the roll, please?
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Freeman?
No.
Representative Holby?
I'm going to vote yes right now, but reserve the right to change my vote on the floor.
Representative Matthews?
I would have bet you would have done that.
Hi. Isn't that illegal in this hall?
Representative Thatcher?
No.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kennemer?
Aye.
Chair Gordy?
Aye. Okay, with that motion carries. Okay, so I close the... We're closed work session on Senate Bill 1537A, and that concludes our business. We do have a bill to be carried. Who's going to carry? Somebody want to carry that? I will. Okay. And on Monday, we are carrying over the Senate bill that we heard this morning, 1520. And we will not be meeting, and we don't know if some other bills are going to be assigned to us. And so on the calendar, we had Monday as an iffy, but since we are carrying over that one bill, we will not meet until 9 a.m.
I love you.
On Monday.
Yeah.
9 a.m.
So there is a nice side to you. Thank you.
Yes, there is. Very, very small. Okay, with that, I adjourn House Committee on Business and Labor. Committee on Business and Labor.